listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight we're going to hear two novelists on the subjects of, and probably many more than this, memory, identity, and place. These are two novelists who continue to experiment with form, to defy conventional narrative, truly two of our country's bravest, most daring fiction writers. Novelist Percival Everett has worked as a musician, a horse trainer, and a teacher. His work is audacious, uncategorizable. In his new novel, Assumption, his follow-up to the wickedly funny I Am Not Sidney Poitier, Everett once again upends our expectations about characters, plot, race, and meaning. The New York Times wrote of Everett's most recent novel, Assumption, Everett casts his line, as it were, pretty far, and some of the things he reels in are weighty indeed: racism, anomie, disillusionment, the meaning or lack thereof of one man's life, the American nightmare in brief at the end of the line. The settings, the protagonists, and the eccentric and pathetic cast of characters will haunt you long after you close the book. Everett is the author of nearly 20 novels. It might have gone up since I last asked him. Three collections of short fiction and two volumes of poetry. Swimmers, Swimmers, Swimming is his newest collection of poetry. He's also an accomplished poet. He's a distinguished professor of English at USC and was awarded the 2002 Hurston Wright Legacy Award for his novel Erasure, which was also recently republished, and we have it for sale tonight, a satiric indictment of race and publishing in America. Steve Erickson's new novel, These Dreams of You, is set in 1960s London, 70s Berlin, 21st century California, and an orphanage in Ethiopia. The New York Times noted in the review of Steve's most recent novel that he has been deemed a surrealist, a visionary, a genius. His fictions play out among the shifting landscapes of sci-fi, postmodernism, and avant-pop. Occasionally, These Dreams of You reads less like a book than a prose contraption engineered to pry us loose from our bearings. So I think you have to all hang on to your seats. Steve Erickson is the author of 8 novels. Currently, he's the film critic for Los Angeles Magazine and editor of the great literary journal Black Hawk, published by Cal Arts, where he teaches in the MFA writing program. And in conversation with our two esteemed novelists tonight is a great playwright, Bridget Mullins. Bridget last interviewed Irish novelist Anne Enright for us. She's both an award-winning playwright and a poet. Her work includes Monkey in the Middle, Fire Eater, and Pathological Venus. She's working on a number of theater projects and is currently the director of the Master of Professional Writing Program at USC and is the recipient of a 2010 United States Artist Fellowship in Literature. It's a wonderful trio here. Please welcome them to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks, Louise, and thanks, everyone, for coming tonight to join us in this impromptu conversation. And I'm thrilled to be here to talk with two of my favorite living novelists about their work and their process. And as Louise noted, they're both prolific. And the playwright Sam Shepard said that you solve the problems of one play in the next play that you write. And he said that when you first learn how to write a play, it's like learning to ride a horse. And then over time, you find out you have to figure out where the horse is going. So you can probably tell that this is forming itself into a question about beginnings and about, especially for two writers who have given us so many novels, and some with recurring themes or ideas, but always it seems the thrown gauntlet of a new structure, a new way of being, a new way of responding to the times, and a cognizance of what our responsibilities are as citizens or what they aren't, how we figure in society. You know, especially I'm thinking here of Steve's book, These Dreams of You, and Percival's book, Assumption, both of which deal with family, but also outsiders. So, you know, I'm just wondering, just as a jumping off point, and maybe if you'd like to read a bit from your work as well, in particular, with these particular novels, or Percival with your latest one, what was the beginning? Is it story? Is it character? Is it, as Shepherd describes it, the thrown gauntlet of a new structural exploration? Is it landscape? Is it a question of where we are now and what we do and how the stories we tell ourselves and others about our lives? Steve, do you want to kick off?
Sure. First of all, I want to thank the Downtown Library and the Aloud series and Louise Steinman for having us. Thank you, Bridget, for moderating this. I'm struck by the Shepherd quote because very often I find that a novel will grow out of the scene I left out of the last novel. I had a particular case of that with a novel called Amnesia Scope some years ago, where 6 months after the novel was published and done, I was doing something banal like grocery shopping, and I had this sort of revelation of a scene that I felt should have gone in that novel, and out of that scene grew the next novel I wrote, which was The Sea Came In at Midnight. I think that it probably varies from book to book. It may be a character, it may be an idea. In the case of this novel, it was a scene that in fact opens the book, and it was a scene that was based in some part on a real scene that had taken place in my life. And it struck me that it was a singular moment for me. It was a singular moment for the country, and out of that, the novel developed.
Do you want to read from
sure,
the opening?
I should do it. I'll do it now. Okay. Again, this is the opening of the new novel called These Dreams of You. And I've kind of compressed it a little bit, but this is pretty close to the way the book actually opens. But years later, on a night in early November, when the wind comes in like a swarm, Alexander Nordock sits in the rocking chair that he borrowed but never gave back, where his wife used to breastfeed their son. It's 8 o'clock where he is, in one of the canyons on the edge of Los Angeles. It's 10 o'clock in Chicago, and thousands of people sweep across the TV screen in the same park where 40 years ago police and protesters rioted at the scene of a great national political convention. And Nordock's country questioned all its possibilities. Alexander's 4-year-old daughter, Sheba, adopted 19 months before from an orphanage in Ethiopia, sits on his lap. Sheba is the color of the man on the television, in whose form the country now has imagined its most unfathomable possibility. Alexander, who goes by Zan, is the color of everyone else in the family, including his wife Viv and his son Parker, whose 12th birthday happens to also be on this day. With the announcement of the man's election, bedlam consumes the living room. He won, Parker explodes, leaping from the couch over a low white formica table that's in the shape of a cloud. He won, he won, he won, he keeps shouting, and Viv cheers too. Sam, Parker stops, baffled by his father's stupefaction. He won. He says, "Aren't you happy?" On the television is the image of an anonymous young black woman who in the grass of the park has fallen to her knees and holds her face in her hands. Do I have the right, Zan wonders, as a middle-aged white man, to hold my face in my hands, and then thinks, no. And holds his face in his hands anyway, silently mortified that he might do something so trite as sob. It's a country that does things in lurches, born in radicalism, then reluctant for years, decades, the better part of centuries, to do anything crazy until it does the craziest thing of all. But it's also a country inherent in its genes, capable of imagining what cannot be imagined, and then, once it's imagined, doing it. 6 years before, another president, a white privileged Texan, swaggered across the deck of an aircraft carrier in a pilot's jacket. A banner unfurled behind him, proclaiming the end of a war that, in fact, was only beginning. It was an image that the country embraced almost as much as it believed it. Now, a black Hawaiian with a Swahili name? It's science fiction, Zan thinks, or at least the sort of history that puts novelists out of business. At the radio station the next day, from where Zan broadcasts four times a week a three-hour music show, he announces following the first set, the Sam Cooke record, the greatest ever made, was for what happened last night. 45 years after the song was recorded, but then all the song says is that a change will come, not how fast, right? By the time the song was released as a B-side, the singer was murdered in an L.A. motel under tawdry circumstances. But is it just me, Zan asks, or when he goes from that bridge into the final verse, does he redeem not only anything he ever did, including whatever it was that got him shot, but everything I ever did too? The national anthem of dreams deferred, sung from the grave by a ghost who doesn't know he's dead. Everything else, Zan goes on, was for the kids, the hip-hop manifesto about brushing the dirt off your shoulder. That's for my 12-year-old son who's gone gangsta lately, though at this point I'm sure he thinks the song is impossibly old school, being as it's more than half an hour old. And the really old school one about the lovers at the Berlin Wall who get to be heroes just for one day, that's for my 4-year-old Ethiopian daughter, who I guess can't get enough of British extraterrestrials in dresses. The 4-year-old Ethiopian glam rocker is the only one in the family not thrilled by the election result. Sheba has been the household sole supporter of the opposing candidate, a man the age of grandfathers and the color of snow, neither of which the small girl has known. Zan has three theories about Sheba's enthusiasm for this candidate. The first and most comfortable is that, in fact, he does remind her of Viv's father, who died 2 years before the little girl was born and whom she sees in all the family photos. The second theory, more vexing if not too unsettling, is that she's just messing with everyone's heads. The third and most troubling theory is that in her 4-year-old soul, she's already come to believe the color of snow is preferable to the color of, well, pick your racist poison, chocolate, coffee, mud. With what brown does she associate? Since she came to live with the Nordox, she's noted more than once that her skin is one color and Zan's, Viv's, and Parker's another. How come, the girl asks resentfully, returning from preschool where there are no other black children, you get to have light skin while mine is darker? Dismayed, Zan isn't sure he's heard right. Was that really the way she put it? Yours is lighter, she points out again, pulling at his arm and thrusting her thumb in her mouth. It is lighter, he says. Yours is darker and it's beautiful. Some people have light skin and some have dark. Some have light hair and some have dark. The man who sings the hero song has red hair, she says. Yes. Mama has blue hair. There you go. Turquoise, actually. What's turquoise, she asks. A kind of blue. Blue-green. Is it really blue, or did she make it blue? She made it blue. Why? She likes it and matches her eyes. Some people have light or dark eyes. Some people are tall. Some aren't. Is this the way to answer the question? Is it better than because you're black and we're white if she doesn't yet have a concept of black and white? Or is it an answer that only a naive white person gives? On the other hand, no white sentimentality invents and no hard-nosed street wisdom disputes the preternatural awareness of the four-year-old adopted child who shares with other abandoned children a perspective verging on the otherworldly. Oh yeah, says another father at Sheba's preschool when Zan identifies her as his. The little girl who talks like she's 20. The night that Zan takes Parker to the emergency room with a broken hand and loses his car keys, he's still railing at the experience an hour later behind the wheel when, from her infant seat and back, Sheba advises, Poppy, let it go, before plopping her thumb back in her mouth. She dazzles everyone she meets, eyes big enough to center whole swirling solar system, her charismatic entrance into every room brings it to a halt. She's an irrepressible goofball, walking around with small stickers stuck to the end of her nose, spitting water across the dinner table in a stream, like the stone water-breathing lion she saw in a fountain, a mimic who spins off her own original permutations. Eventually, the mimicry becomes not only more precocious, but blacker, inevitable less because she herself is black than because her white brother, like all kids in the 21st century, or maybe all kids since the first white boy or girl heard Louis Armstrong blow his horn, is blacker. Hey there, girlfriend, or what up, sweet cheeks, to people who probably shouldn't be greeted in that fashion. Now the only way Zan knows to conclude the conversation with Sheba about the difference between his skin and hers is to say some squishy white liberal thing like, you're beautiful. Silently adding to no one, you come up with something better. Sheba takes her thumb from her mouth, locks his eyes with hers, and draws a finger across her throat.
Thank you.
So that opening scene of watching the election of the first African-American president took place pretty much like that in our family, where we have an adopted African daughter, mm-hmm. And you know, I knew it was a scene that was unusual for my life, and that it was happening at a time that was unusual and historic for the country. And as the story of the book develops, it happens against the backdrop. Of what else is going on.
Mm-hmm. And that little girl, the verisimilitude, is, to my mind, so striking. Because if you spent any time around four-year-olds, as I know you have, Percival, they say very wise things.
Well, and in fact, the one objection that my editor had to the manuscript when I turned it on was he said, I don't believe that a four-year-old would say these things. Mm-hmm. And I think you and I were talking about this at dinner a few months ago, where, you know, it's the last refuge of a bad writer is to say, yeah, but it happened in real life. you know, if it doesn't work on the page, it doesn't work. And I wound up actually taking things out because though my daughter may be unbelievable, my characters can't be.
Mm. Thank you. And turning to Percival, this I know that you have a new book that you want to talk about. And as Louise said, you might have written a new book in the time that we crossed the stage. But there's so much that reminds me of, not to quote again, but de Kooning said, I work, other people call it art. And that this just seems like your relationship to reality and your way of being is very connected to making things. And so in terms of that, I mean, I just to go back to character for a moment, I really like that character of Ogden. I like how he is such a loner. He doesn't even have a pet. He has a bonsai because he doesn't have to walk it. And he's just this wonderful outsider. He's this American original, this outsider. And I just wonder, was he this jumping off point? Was it character for assumption?
I never know. It's to me that any words end up on a blank page is magic. and I tried not to question it too much. Mm-hmm. You know, novels come differently, as Steve was saying. Every one is his own life, and I don't always know the origin of this thing that's sort of flailing in front of me. One of my novels was the product of having been dissatisfied with the story for my entire childhood, the story of Medea. And it just always bugged me. I said, this can't be right. And so I rewrote it my way. And then there was another that came to me in Wyoming when I stopped at a rest area. And I wondered, what would it be like to work here? And the novel just came.
Mm-hmm.
And still another came when I saw, I used to have a ranch outside Los Angeles, and the exit to my place was the run right before it was called Theodore Street. And as I turned off, I looked at it, it said Theodore Street, and that became the name of my character.
Mm-hmm.
so it's just kind of magic, but for me it always comes out of sort of fascination with language and meaning.
At dinner earlier, you did say something about story and how it doesn't, or that story isn't what it's about for you in some way. And I asked you what you had studied, and it was math. And there is some, it feels like there's a real pleasure in playing with logic and with form. In the novels of yours that I've read, there's that seems to me to be the through line, that there is such a joy in playing with these different ways of making something.
Well, meaning gets made in so many different ways that not just a context. It's the way the context is constructed. And what's in place to create the context. So I just become fascinated with the layers of meaning, and that's what I like to play with.
Mm-hmm.
Then sort of accidentally I end up telling a story, but mm-hmm. I don't think I'm really a naturally a good storyteller.
I think you are, but I also think there's also a lot of pleasure to be had for a reader in the way that you play with theory. It's like a cat playing with a little, batting it around.
I like to think of it more as a cat playing with a dead mouse.
Okay. but that what you said about the layers, it does seem like there's always something, and Steve is doing this in his other work, and I think in the new book as well, something meta-narrative, the writer who's a writer writing about a writer and the time shifts, and I wonder with the new book, not with Assumption, but the one that will be published, when will it be coming out?
In about a year, early next year.
And what's the name of it?
I can't really say.
Okay.
Well, I can, but it's kind of embarrassing. The title of the novel is Percival Everett.
would you read a bit?
Yeah, and actually I think in some way it answers at least part of the question. Maybe it's more confusing than anything. It's a section, the second phase of desire. Lying here like this, I have learned some things about us and learned nothing at all. And it is the nothing at all that sings to me in this cucumbery trance that we may assume. We may choose to assume that at any given state of affairs, that as any given state of affairs is upset, that there arises an instinct to make them anew. And as we set about, we entertain all these words, all these thoughts, notions, utterances, calculations, equations, text, all of this language, all of this, and language remains always a step ahead of us. And we think this most clearly as we die, a step, two steps ahead of us. Our speaking, our writing, our groping always lags behind language, far enough that there is nothing to say about language itself, as we cannot look directly upon its magnificence. Like simile and Zeus, burn, baby, burn, and yet a Hegelian desire, a Freudian instinct, no matter how much we yak, how much we entangle ourselves in words and text, all we ever do is circle where we think language might reside. guessing like we guess about the location of electrons, about positrons and pions and muons and kaons and leptons and quarks and imaginary ducks, using it without pause, without thought, knowing that we cannot live without it, that we define ourselves with it and by it, but it is not ours. It found us, waited for us to find it. We evolved to find it waiting, and we explore its structure, the structure we impose. Believe we add to its content daily, recognize its turns, its fluidity, its features, its alterability, and yet we cannot account for it, explain it, find the egg of it, because it is, in short, God, the only God that we know or will know or have known, it being immaterial, without form or mass or weight or constituent parts, the identification of parts of speech being little more than an exercise in question begging. Like describing judgments by examples of things judged, it is completely dependent on us, and yet we give it nothing. Just as digging more ditch makes the ditch no more a ditch, and it dies every day and yet continues to live, lives in its units that we cannot see or hear, that we cannot see or hear them, so big that we cannot miss them, and we can represent none of them, as it exists without senses, without medium, without intention, without reflection or deflection, but not without us, as it makes us human, forces us to be human, reminds us to be human, yet has no feeling toward us, gives us life, conflict, confusion, war, and understanding, and it is all powerful and without judgment, and it can state its own apparent inadequacy and then overcome it. Revealing that we are the site of the failure, create context, is not the sum of its parts, and we cannot see, imagine the whole of it, cannot imagine it at all, and it creates gods for us to pray to, gods for us to fear and love, creates religions and then refutes them, creates a way for us to talk about the unknown, about language itself and yet does not create itself, is not created, just is. And we cannot imagine ourselves without it, cannot imagine without it, because it is God, and it lets us know that God is just a word, that God is just a grammar, and that its grammar is just our feeble construct to approach its radiance. It has nothing to do with text, it has nothing to do with words, and probably has nothing to do with our thoughts and the things we think when we know nothing, when we know there is nothing, when nothing is our last safe cave of language. And vegetable me, the skies and the river, the moons and the sea, the birds speak of riddles and the dolphins tell lies, and we'll all feel it forever and nobody dies.
I think we can all go home now.
Is that the opening?
No.
No. Where does it come in the book?
Well, this is sort of in the middle. It's hard to say. This novel's very strange. That's all I can tell you.
There's when you're talking about grammar, the etymology of grammar is the same as glamour, where magic mm-hmm. comes from. So that kind of like word coining thing that you're doing, is it an interior monologue with the character, or are there other parts going on?
It's, you never quite know in this novel. It's I call it pin the tail on the narrator. it's a very difficult novel to talk about. It's mm-hmm. it. To be boring for a second, it comes out of my working title for it was Sin and Bedeutung, you know, sense and reference, about Frege's puzzle, and because everything for me comes out of some stupid philosophy thing, and so that's what where this comes from, and so it's all about substitutions.
Mm-hmm. Of language for experience?
For everything, just and.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that seems connected to your process in some way. That was this writing this book different from writing your other books, and that was it a longer process?
It took a while. I kept, because I just never understood it. I'm not sure I do now. When I finished it, it's such a strange book that I sent it to my agent, my thought being, no one will publish this. And my agent said, I really like this. And my first thought was, I need a new agent. But I fooled a lot of people with this so far. We'll see how far it goes.
And then, it is being published. So.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, much to my surprise.
Do you have a feeling that your readers have a certain expectation? You said you didn't write it with any thought of publication. Do you write for a thought of some ideal reader or audience? Or?
Yeah, me. I don't think about audience.
Yeah.
Sorry. Writer's different. Reader's different. I can't.
Is it another version of yourself, though, that you're writing for?
I don't know. I've never thought about it in that way. But it would have to be, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Steve, would you talk a little bit about your process? I know we have a lot of students here tonight from the USC Master Professional Writing Program, and probably from CalArts, and probably undergraduates from USC. And there are enabling ways of speaking about process, I think, for writers. Right now I'm teaching Tennessee Williams, and he has this whole section about his day, and his day always involved a swim, a drink, and lots of time at the typewriter. And he said the perfect life for an artist is the one, or for him, was the one that made the work not only necessary but impossible to avoid. And there is something about that. What is it that, because you're both, you know, the work is so consistently surprising and so innovative and speaks to our time, and you know, they're both, Assumption and These Dreams of You were both, for me, page turners. Not like in an old school kind of suspense way, but just where are they going with this, you know, and how did we get into this? So I think in terms of that, with your process, Steve, because These Dreams of You is very much this family story, and this historical novel where the roots of this family intersect with Joyce, with Berlin. There's a dreamscape, there's a soundscape with the music. And what I really loved so much about this is the way that coincidence figures and happenstance, which is probably something that goes into your work as well, this idea of the thing that's sort of off the chart, that happens, that can happen, that happens. And that gets a texture of reality into the book. Somewhere in that little stew pot of ideas, I would love to hear you talk about your process, if you would.
Yeah. I find, and I'm guessing that maybe from what Percival was saying, he finds as well that, you know, a lot of this is really intuitive. At least in my case, it's not especially thought out when I begin. It's a cliche of a writing, but I think it's true that the character tends to drive the story. If you know who your people are, then at some point, I've had instances where I was working on a novel and I thought that I was going to get to this section and this was going to happen. And I got there and I realized that what I had planned was that the guy was going to call up his girlfriend and have this long conversation. And when I got there, I realized that the guy would hang up the phone before she answered. I mean, I knew that character well enough. So that whole conversation that was in my head, went out the window because I think you have to be true to the characters, and you've got to be open to, you know, and forgive me if this sounds overly mystical, but you've got to be open to what the characters are going to tell you and what the book is going to tell you about itself. And that's why I think it's probably, you know, it's difficult to talk about this process. I don't make an outline. I rarely work from notes. I have found that when I'm writing from an outline, the result sounds like it was written from an outline. And I hasten to add that I know very good writers who outline extensively. So there's not a particular way of doing this. Every writer's got a method to his own madness.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, it's certainly not the kind of thing everybody's relationship to their work.
And then later on, you bring some conscious rationale to what you're doing or what you've done.
Is that in the revision?
Or? Absolutely. And I mean, in the case of this novel, there are a lot of things going on in this novel. And, you know, about 3 months before I finished the draft, I woke up one night at 2 a.m. thinking, I must be insane. There's all this stuff going on in this novel. There's no way that this novel can contain it. And I had this kind of panic attack, and I kind of talked myself back from the ledge and went back to sleep and woke up the next morning and read over what I had written and realized that it wasn't quite the disaster that things sometimes seem at 2 o'clock in the morning. But I also had a moment of clarity that I hadn't had before. I realized that all of this other stuff going on, whether it's about politics or history or music or riffs on the New Testament or all of this stuff did have to fit under the umbrella of this family story.
Mm-hmm.
That, mm-hmm. That if it didn't, the novel was going to be out of balance and was going to kind of spin out of control. So that kind of thought does go into the process, but in my case, it goes into the process pretty late in the game. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking about that stuff when I'm first telling the story.
And the story, you go so many different places, and my book is so marked up. The way that music comes in and out, and the way that the character locates himself in place, and this is a line about halfway through the book. He says, he is of and from a country, this is Zan, he is of and from a country that always has belonged to the rest of the world's imagination more than it belongs to its own. And throughout the book, there is this incredible shape of the sentence that you're doing, this structural elegance. It's parts of it almost read like Zen koans. I mean, it's very... and I think maybe that's part of why you're able to... You're doing some really far-out stuff. It's really an unbelievable book. And Percival, I know you don't want to talk about this book so much, Assumption.
Sure.
But the structure was so compelling to me. And actually, this idea about character that Steve was saying, this idea that if your characters aren't surprising you, you're not writing them enough. And it seemed that this character of Ogden, who I just, you know, I would follow him anywhere, and I did. And it almost seemed like he didn't know himself throughout. And that is such a coup d'etat. Like, that to me is, you know, that whether you were withholding or the character, not to get too metaphysical here, the character was withholding himself from you. And to see how he pulls this off, you really have to read the book. Because it's written in three narrative chunks. And there are three self-contained stories where a detective is following clues. But they're always about finding out who he is and what he has done. But we think it's about something else up until a certain point, and then it's not an epiphany per se, but it's kind of a failed epiphany that we get. And it's a disturbing book because of that. Very disturbing book.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
The Percival's novel is about 225 pages, and without giving away too much, if you stop on page 210, thinking, you know, well, I've read 210 pages, so I get this, you are not really reading the novel that you're really reading.
Yeah.
And I, what I'm curious about, without giving away too many trade secrets here, is at what point you knew that about Ogden in the writing of the book, whether you knew it from the get-go or whether it was something you found out as you were telling the story.
That was the question I was trying to ask. Thank you, Steve.
Well, I played with this character for a long time, and it never became a novel for me until I figured out the end, and then, mm-hmm. then I had a novel.
Right, right.
Before that, I was terribly bored by it. The setting, the place, is very important to me, New Mexico, and part of living through the novel was I got to live in New Mexico, and I got to, and it made me sort of happy. What I like about the novel is he's a really bad detective. He's just not very good at this, and it was fun placing clues about him throughout that wouldn't be, you know, obvious.
But he never comes off as a bumbling fool.
No, he's not a dumb guy. He's just a bad
right.
detective.
Yeah.
He's lost in thought a lot of the time, yeah. and he has these philosophical quandaries if this situation is indeed a situation. And then, you know, there's always some other dimension he's going to that he's experiencing. And I love the way throughout he's fishing, literally fishing, and tying flies, and just you get the feeling that he's an artist of everyday life. He has this beautiful relationship, weird relationship with his mother. And he's a storyteller. I mean, he has these memories and these flashbacks that come in that seem to epitomize like the story about the dog.
I don't remember.
But place, if anybody else here is a desert rat, as I am, I grew up in the Mojave Desert, the way that you write about the place does seem very, it's very particular for this loner, for this kind of spiritual existential thing that's going on out there in the desert by himself with his bonsai. And both of you, I know we have to open this up to questions in a few minutes because Louise's structure, which is so wonderful and works so well. And I know we have lots of questions brewing out there, but I did want to ask both of you as writers who live and work in Los Angeles, how does place, you said you went to New Mexico to or you were living in New Mexico when you wrote Assumption, or was it?
No, I've just spent lots of time there, and so it's a part of me. I didn't have to go do research.
Yeah, it was there. Yeah. It was embedded. And how does living in Los Angeles or being a writer in this place? And when I was living on the East Coast and teaching there, I found all my students wanted to come to L.A., and then I ended up coming here myself. But when I grew up on the West Coast, I just wanted to get to the East Coast. But it does seem like it's really a place for writers now, and there's a lot of activity going on, and I just wonder what your experience is. You've both lived here for about 20 years, and you're from here.
I was born and raised here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a difference between Angelenos who were born and raised here and Angelenos who have come here.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've often come here looking for something. And, you know, in my case, I grew up less in the Hollywood L.A. and more in the aerospace L.A. I grew up in the L.A. that was transformed by, John Kennedy's decision to go to the moon, because mm-hmm. all of those aerospace industries were out in the San Fernando Valley. And transformed the San Fernando Valley within a matter of 6 or 7 or 8 years. All of which was to say that my LA was a different LA than it didn't fit the conception of LA
mm-hmm.
that people had.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to to leave for a while and go live in other places, live in Europe, or mm-hmm. to really understand, you know, what a strange city this is. And, yeah. and it's a very strange city.
Yeah, yeah. Percival, do you know?
I love Los Angeles. It's, well, partly it's in the West. When I was 19 and drove west for the first time, that I realized this is my landscape. And as cities go, and if I have to live in a city, I do now, Los Angeles is the city I would choose. It's the most international city in the U.S. And it's a kind of a neat place because it really doesn't have a chip on its shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
Los Angeles doesn't care about you. You know? it's like everybody else, every other place says, oh, this is a great place. L.A. doesn't care.
And I think especially for literary artists, it's there's not the same kind of self-consciousness there is in Boston or San Francisco or New York.
You know, if you live in Paris or New York, you may not know who you are, but you know you're a New Yorker. You know, the city imposes an identity, and this is the blank slate of a city, you know. And if you kind of know what you want to do, it's great, and it leaves you alone. And if you don't know what you want to do, you wind up walking up and down Hollywood Boulevard talking to yourself.
I think that's a great...
You weren't supposed to mention that.
That seems like a really good place to open it up to questions from the audience. And I think there will be a mic circulating, so if you raise your hand, thank you.
Thank you. Steve, I had a question for you. You were talking about character and developing a character. My question was, how much time do you spend thinking about the character, its quirks, its loves, its hates, before you actually start putting it on the page?
That, too, is going to vary from novel to novel. I mean, probably the best instance I can give of that is the novel that came before this one, which was called Zeroville. And it's a novel about the movies, which is to say it's not a novel about making movies. It's a novel about being obsessed with movies. And I had this in my head for you know a couple of years, and it wasn't until the central character really came into focus that the rest of the novel fell into place. Because once I had the central character, I had the perspective, I had the voice, I had the sensibility of the novel. There are going to be other instances where I'm finding out who the character is, kind of like I mentioned before, as I'm telling the story, and the characters will assert themselves and start dictating their own actions. But in the end, I think that once your characters take on lives of their own, that's when the novel does.
Both especially for exposing yourselves so honestly. My question to you both is, when did you each decide that you were a writer?
Tomorrow.
They're going to let you get away with that. I don't think I can top that. No, I decided pretty early. You know, for a number of reasons, when I was a little kid, it was an escape for me, and I found out that it was the one thing I was pretty good at, and I knew pretty early on.
I started publishing fairly young, but I sort of stumbled into it. I didn't know that I was going to be a writer, and in many ways I'm serious about it. I still don't feel like an imposter most of the time.
Maybe the 25th book will clear that up for you.
I forget which one of you is the genius.
I'm kidding. I'm fascinated, Percival. I have spent some little while in theoretical physics, and I find it hard to believe that you're a mathematician or the. I think you're more oriented toward physics. Actually, you must be. You're not a. You don't work in syntactical calculus or something like that, do you?
Well, let's back up. It's not exactly math. I studied mathematical logic when as an undergraduate, which is a far cry from being a mathematician. I enjoy logic and math.
I have a question for each of you, and it is merely this. recently, I reread Crime and Punishment, and you know, here's a novel that was rewritten several times, and every time he rewrote it, I was thinking about you, Steve, in the introduction. In your first comments, you said you wished you had the opportunity to add that scene. Now, in Crime and Punishment, it's completely additive. Every time he rewrote it, he added more. If things were different nowadays and there weren't such pressures to publish and to get after the next book, do you think that, and this goes to each of you, do you think that you would, a year later, add more or pare it down? Thanks.
Depends on the work. I always cut as much as I can.
Yeah, I agree with that. I find that my novels tend to get shorter instead of longer. That is, the more I work on them, they get shorter. In the case of this novel, as I was mentioning before, I felt that all these kind of rifts that the novel goes into had to fit under the umbrella of the family story. Well, that meant balancing and orchestrating a lot of different components. And as I tried to achieve that balance, the book got shorter and shorter. I mean, the original was probably 50 pages longer than this. So, and that generally has been the process for me, that when I finish something, it's probably going to wind up fewer pages instead of more pages. Mm.
Hi, Percival. I see your work as having a protagonist in an absurd position, and I'm just wondering if you could tell me the function of humor in that universe.
I can't help but be ironic, and inside, I guess often that comes off as humor. If not, then it's just kind of nasty, and I don't want to be nasty. My instruction as a writer and thinker comes from Mark Twain, Groucho Marx, and Bullwinkle, and there I went from them. I learned that to address from Mark Twain anyway, to address serious stuff, it works for you to disarm with humor. And so that, I don't think about that, but it's probably encoded in me somehow genetically, I guess.
Percival, in the excerpt that you read, I think you said language remains ahead of us, and you equated language with God. It reminded me of the quote, the Heidegger quote, "Language is the house of being. There's nothing outside of language." Does that ever feel, or is it freeing?
Well, I suppose if I sat around thinking, it's pretty suffocated. The magic of language is pretty freeing. That it's as much a part, and this is from Wittgenstein, as much a part of human history as walking and talking. I mean, as walking, and it's not something separate from us. It is us. There's no world, and but yet there it is, this thing that we approach, and it frustrates us, and gives us so much. Right? Yes, and as I start to think about it like that, I become suffocated.
We are actually nearing the conclusion of this amazingly interesting philosophical meditation on Steve. I'm thinking of the section of your book with the lecture that the novelist gives in London about the obsolescence potentially of the novel, and it's about narrative and the Bible, and you know, there's so much food for thought here. And I think with both of these books, it was such a pleasure to read them in tandem and to know that I would be able to speak to both of you tonight about them. And I know there is a kind of really deep, deep pleasure in reading both of your work. And it's even the joy of being disturbed by the work, and also of seeing the way that history sort of crashes into our lives, and that final scene with the family is phenomenal. I mean, and there's just so much phenomenal and bewildering in both of these books about the power of language and character and story and the stories we tell ourselves. And I would just really encourage those of you who are interested in this and in pushing the form forward, which is something I would usually hesitate to say in front of these guys, but it's what they're doing, and it's really, it feels to me like there's such great hope for us as storytellers and especially as readers. And I would also encourage you, I think there's a jar out in the lobby.
No more jar?
No jar? Okay, there is a jar in Tennessee, as Wallace Stevens says, but there is membership to support this amazing series, which I think is the most interesting literary series probably in the United States right now, and that's due to Louise. And thank you all for coming. And you guys are signing books.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.